Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. The nor'easter has left. Thank God. The sun is shining. It's cold outside. And I think if it gets a little bit warmer, maybe even the ice will melt. But it's going to get really hot in here because we've got the author of Death Theory, John Mims, here. And this book, well, you got to be really careful. This is fantastic. Man's greatest fear is also its greatest obsession, what awaits when we shuffle off the mortal coil of this world. We all have our beliefs based on faith or science, but both struggle to provide a tangible answer. Well, following the violent death of his parents, Jeff Granger seeks reassurance that they have moved on. A lot of people wonder about that, and they will if you wonder if they could speak to someone after they're gone. So, good morning, John. This should be interesting. Hi.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, hanging in there, trying to stay warm.
Yep.
So this book, could you give everybody like a short summary of the book before we get into my major questions here?
Well, it's a group of people that kind of come together because they have certain motivations, interests, that kind of lead them toward the paranormal. And they each have their own reason for getting into paranormal investigation. And I kind of drew from some of that from my experience I had in paranormal investigation. You have so many different people, so many different reasons that come into the field. And it kind of showed the struggle that they went through, not only with trying to stay within scientific means, but trying to control the drama within the group. But, of course, this is kind of a murder mystery book, and it kind of takes a whole different tangent when it comes to paranormal research.
Yeah, well, you did a lot of research, and you're in this field. That must be interesting to be able to tell somebody if they could actually see somebody after they're gone. I always wondered about that. So, what technology is needed in this particular case? They use something called an EVP. Why is that the first element to trigger our main character's desire to learn more about hearing his mother's voice? And does this really work in real life?
Well, there are so many different, forms that people use to investigate, whether it be photography, monitoring the environment, things like that. All of those can have prosaic, explanatory explanations, but this one, EVP, is something that really, it kind of leaves people scratching their head. There's no scientific theory for it. I mean, there's some theories, but none of them really make sense. But it is, it's creepy. I'm going to put it.
Yeah.
And I've caught several EVPs myself, and I can't explain it. I mean, it's to be talking and hear a voice come across on the recorder that wasn't there when the recording was made. That's just, it's mind blowing, and I think that's the main bit of evidence that keeps people going in the paranormal field.
That would be scary. I mean, I often wondered. I lost my sister recently, and I never got to hear what she wanted to tell me. When she hung up that day, she called me about a couple hours before, and she said, I need to tell you something, and she never told me what it was. And I knew that something was wrong, and I always wondered what would happen if I could actually hear her voice so she could tell me what really happened. That would, I don't know, it's kind of spooky, but kind of interesting. So we've got, tell me.
Most EVPs are not long sentences or explanations. Most of them are one or two words.
Mm-hmm.
But the scary thing is that, let's say if you're investigating somewhere where a young child died, you might pick up a child's voice, which kind of correlates with what you're looking for, or you might pick up an older person's voice. But very rarely have I heard more than, a couple of words in an EVP. It's usually something like get out or no, or, some simple phrase like that.
It's scary. It is scary. But sometimes you just want to hear somebody's voice that makes you feel as if they're still there. I often go on my sister's Facebook wall, especially yesterday when it was really bad outside, and she always told me that she can control the weather. I guess she must have been in a bad mood because we got all that snow and all the power lines are down and everything. I was just lucky that it's working. So I guess sometimes, you know, they don't listen. So we've got Jeff Granger, Pack, Aaron Elvis, I love Elvis, and Debbie. Why did they want to go into this, and what was their purpose? Each one had a different reason.
Well, Jeff lost his parents in a car accident, and it kind of, they were his only family, and it kind of left him in a rut. He was lonely, and like so many people get into paranormal, he was watching one of the TV shows, and he found some of the evidence on there, particularly EVP, compelling, and so he decided to go to his parents' crash site and do a EVP session himself, and that kind of got him motivated into it because he got a response from his mother. Elvis lost his wife, and he, kind of a similar situation. She was all he had, and he's trying to come to terms with it. He's wanting to reach out to her, just talk to her one more time. Debbie, on the other hand, is more like a lot of people that get into it. It's more out of curiosity. She always liked ghost stories, and she's kind of curious about the whole thing. But she, at least, you know, for those who read the book, she didn't think she had a reason to get into it. As we find out later in the book, she actually did.
Well, she finally did. I know that. But some of what happened was really like, oh, my God, that was really scary. So each of these have special issues to conquer. Debbie has nightmares. Pack's relationship with his mother. Elvis and his late wife, Vicky, and Jeff and his parents' accident. So how do they deal with that? And how did they realize that they needed to find out more? I mean, everybody has nightmares at times. Everybody has to deal with issues and relationships. So why those particular ones? And will this help it?
Well, Debbie's was more along the lines of kind of a repressed memory. She had a traumatic situation, as you'll find out in the book, later, early in her life. And there was a trigger that kind of started bringing those memories to the surface. And they started manifesting themselves in nightmares at first. Jeff and Elvis, they're both basically just looking. It's kind of the grieving aspect. They're looking for just one more chance to talk to their loved ones.
That is scary. Like I said, it would be really nice if people could actually do that, could really do that, and actually get an answer. I mean, what is the difference between this and a seance? If they decided to have a seance, they did. So how would that be different?
Well, a seance is done through a medium, and the scientific, or the, excuse me, the paranormal research I was in, we tried to stick strictly to science. You know, measurable empirical data that shows repeatability. A seance really doesn't fall into the scientific method. It's, spirit is allegedly talking to a person. But I guess the bottom line is it can't be measured, you know, scientifically, so there's no basis of comparability to claim that that's actually what that is, you know, spirit talking to a person.
So John Edwards actually does talk to these people? Is that supposed to be real? He does actually connect with these people? There are people that can actually do that?
You're talking about a seance?
Yeah.
Supposedly. I've never attended one, never done one, anything like that, but that's the theory behind it.
I don't think I'd want to either. So there's a character that, well, I'm not going to say if I like him or dislike him, Who is Dr. Staples, and what oddity does we receive when he's added to be when he has to include this as an important issue in his book?
What doctor? Are you talking about his motivation mainly for?
Yeah, why did they include him? Who was he, and how did they meet this guy?
Well, he was the counselor, if you will. He used to be a psychiatrist. He's not practicing anymore. But he's the one that Debbie went to when she started having her nightmares, when she kind of reached a breaking point that she wasn't getting any better with him. And during the course of their sessions, it came out that she was involved in paranormal research, and Dr. Staples was fascinated by that because he wanted to kind of examine it from a psychiatric point of view. He wanted to know, he didn't believe in it, but he wanted to see what mental triggers, you know, could trigger people having paranormal experiences or things of that nature. So he asked if he could kind of come along as an observer on their investigations.
We won't say too much more about that. So how does jealousy come into play in this book?
Well, kind of a, I guess you would say a love triangle between two of the guys and the girl on the team. And that, I kind of wrote that into the book because that's something that seems to be commonplace in paranormal research. Not necessarily romantic jealousy, but jealousy of attention and things like that. Everybody wants to have the newest, brightest idea. Everybody wants to have the next radio or TV show. And that's part of the problem that paranormal research has, because you have so many people going at it from different motivations.
I know, that's like strange. I don't know. This is like such a difficult, you know, sensitive area that I wonder how many people really want to be able to speak to someone or hear the voice or whatever, or not get worse or not get scarier. So what is the death theory, and what happens when someone dies? That's what really scared me. Where does their energy go? I think a lot of people want to know that.
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And that was, the death theory was something that Jeff and Elvis kind of bantered about when they were having beer and steak one night. And it's kind of the end-all, be-all of paranormal research. It's basically monitoring somebody at the moment of death, having scientific equipment set up and everything to read energy transference at time of death. It's based on the law of conservation of energy that says that matter or energy can either be created or destroyed. It merely changes form. So their death theory, if you will, is that the body's energy, which could theoretically be the soul, changes from one form to another at the point of death. And they were discussing how interesting it would be if that could be monitored.
I wonder what would happen if somebody actually monitored a body that was really just not, that was dead in a morgue, and tried to figure out if the person's energy was there. That's I wonder sometimes. I mean, would they ever do something like that?
Not that I've never heard of anybody doing it. I mean, it would be unethical to do it without their permission, even with their permission. It's kind of,
strange. It's a lot of things. So I was standing there when my mother died, and I looked at her to go, "Where are you now?" And that was an answer that you can't get. She looked peaceful. And she looked at me right before, and she just said, "It's time to go, no more." And she had a feeling to whatever, and I looked at her and said, "Where do you think you're going?" And you wonder sometimes, you know, where are you? Are you there? Are you still here? And it's just so weird. So they decided that they were going to branch out and ask different people if they wanted their help. How come they decided that they were going to take on requests to help other people And how did that work?
Well, that's the quickest and easiest way to continue your research. I mean, you have to have a research topic in order, or subject rather, in order to continue it. And so when people would have problems, you know, they would go out and investigate it and hoping to get evidence of paranormal, but more than likely, or more commonly, as you know, in the book, they usually found a simple explanation for whatever was bothering the person.
So we have Jean. Go on.
I was just going to say, I had an instance one time that was kind of a catalyst for some of these people's investigation. There was an old hospital near us that had been abandoned for years, and they gutted it and turned it into a retirement living center. And not too long after it opened, several of the elderly tenants there started complaining about seeing somebody, a child or something, in their room, having somebody pressing on their chest in the middle of the night, you know, things of that nature. And so we went and investigated, and we found out real quickly that they had, all the residents had these same cordless phones in their room, and they all had one by their chair in the living room, by the one in the bedroom, and that's the two places where they were having the incidents. They were either in bed or sitting in their chair, and when we tested the EMF on these phones, it was over 400 milligauss. And the normal environmental milligauss in a house or any place shouldn't be more than 1 or 2 milligauss. So the milligauss was off the chart on the electromagnetic reading, and high electromagnetic fields like that can cause people to hallucinate and to have shortness of breath and to feel sick and things like that. So we told them there at the home they need to get rid of those phones and replace them. So it's not always a ghost, but it's sometimes just as satisfying to find something like that as it is to find something paranormal.
Well, you used that in the book. Mrs. Schwindler's phones were no good, right? Things were happening. And she think they were happening to her. I know. I just said, oh, my God, that was in the book. So who is Jean? And what is a demonologist? And Jeff doesn't like this guy. How come? Well, there are a couple of people.
Well, Jean was a member of one of Jeff's former groups, because Jeff, he joined probably 4 or 5 groups before he decided he was going to have to form his own. Jean was in one of those groups, and he was a demonologist. A demonologist is kind of a fancy title that somebody just gives themselves. There's no accreditation or anything like that. It's somebody who's supposedly an expert on demons. And
how is that scary?
Jeff didn't put a whole lot of stock in that because, again, it's not scientific. You know, he claims that there's a demon, or there's a demon here, there's a demon there, and there's no empirical data to back that up.
Well, how would they prove that somebody was there? How would they prove a demon was there, if a demon really was there? Sometimes you actually think that there's something evil happening, and you can't figure out why.
Well, I 100% believe in demons and things like that. That they are active in this world just as angels are, but sometimes it can be mental illness, and that's probably the most common thing that's mistaken for demon possession. But they are there and they are active. So it's like I said, I'm not somebody who's really researched that or anything, but it's really not a field I really want to dabble with. I think that's something that most people should stay away from.
I don't want to even know. Oh, my God. So we've got Jeff and Debbie. They get closer at times, and at times they feel apart. But when she goes to ask her granny about her past and about her mother, why does her granny get upset? She literally throws them out.
Well, she told Debbie that her mother died of an illness. And when Debbie started putting two and two together from her dreams, her grandmother knew the truth, but it really upset her that Debbie was asking these questions now. And she, of course, the grandmother knows the truth, and she didn't want to discuss it with Debbie.
She didn't want her to know. That's scary. So tell us about the place. They investigated different places. How did you create the different scenes for the different places that they decided to investigate?
Well, I've actually been to Pythian Castle before, and it's a really fascinating place in Springfield, Missouri. Whether it's haunted or not, you know, I don't know, but it's really, there's been some interesting data collected there. And some of the private residences were based on some of the private residences I've actually investigated myself. And the bed and breakfast was kind of loosely based on one we did in Southwest Arkansas. So it's not directly from these investigations, but, you know, a lot of them borrowed heavily from them.
That must be fun. Did you ever join an investigation on the Paranormal Channel? Because they have the psychic channels. They have all of that on television. Did you ever join one of those?
I kind of did something with the guys that did Ghost Lab for a while. You remember that show?
Well, that's interesting, though. That must be fun, though. This is an interesting field, though, I'll tell you that. So what is EnviroMux, and what does it do? I found that interesting, too.
It's an environmental monitoring system, and it's most commonly used in, like, computer mainframe rooms to monitor environmental conditions. You know, if that's a really sensitive area, they can't let the humidity or temperature get up without a certain range. And most of the monitoring systems, whether it's humidity, temperature, you know, everything that they monitor, is usually wired to a network cable in those computer rooms. But in the modification for paranormal research, they had remote sensors that connected back to this server. That's what Dr. Staples had purchased. And they're, the whole system, especially the remote ones, are extremely expensive. That's why most paranormal groups don't have anything like that. But when you go into a place that you're investigating and you're going to do it scientifically, which you should do, you go into each room that you're going to be investigating, you take baseline readings with temperature, humidity, EMF, everything like that, and you record those. And then if you have any instances throughout the night, you compare it with a baseline to see if there was a variation in the environment at that time. Well, the EnviroMux makes it easy. It records and monitors for you all night long, so you don't have to go through there and, you know, correlate it yourself. It does it for you. That's something we always talk about.
Did they ever record, I'm like, Debbie had nightmares and Jeff had nightmares, and did they ever record, would they ever record somebody's nightmares so that they could hear them, so maybe they could deal with them in any kind of way?
Did they record the nightmare?
Yeah, would anybody ever record their nightmares? I mean, Jeff knew that Debbie had nightmares. He wouldn't record them so that she could replay them and see what she's dealing with, and maybe get over them? Was that too dangerous?
Well, as you know, and I won't spoil anything from the book, usually when Debbie first woke up, was dealing with another issue, and yeah, it was due to this repressed memory. And so a lot of times if you have a night, wake up, if you don't record it immediately, it leaks right out of your brain. Because sometimes I'll wake up and I've had a dream, I can remember it for about 10 seconds, and all of a sudden it's gone. So
well, what's
she
the
really
difference
didn't
between a, that's scary. What's the difference between a nightmare and a lucid dream? Is that the different or the same? Would you remember a lucid dream faster or not?
Perhaps. I think a lot of that depends on how deep of the sleep you're in. If you're in a really deep sleep, that's typically the time that you have dreams and you don't even remember them even when you wake up.
Yeah, that's very true. And then they. What about a lucid dream?
A lucid dream is when, I think, when people are kind of teetering on the verge of sleep and being awake, and, you know, they're having a dream, but they're still kind of sort of awake. So that's not a very deep sleep. And that's one reason they're kind of, I think, able to garner more detail and remember more from it.
So would that be, your nightmare is something that scares you and bothers you. A lucid dream, would that be something that happened to you that you just want to remember? I've had lucid dreams about school and about other things, but I don't know. I don't have nightmares. I'm just wondering.
It could be. I mean, every person's brain is different. They all have their own experiences, and, you know, they all manifest themselves differently. So it's really hard to say, you know, except on a case-by-case basis.
I know. It's like scary. I don't know. So we have Mrs. Schwinner and Mrs. Gage. Tell us about their cases and how they were the same and how they were different. That Mrs. Schwinner's case scared me. And Mrs. Gage, whoa, that really scared me.
They were, Ms. Schwinner was basically like we were discussing earlier about the phones. She was having hallucinations. She was having feeling like people pressing on her chest when she was in bed, smothering her, things of that nature. And she, of course, nobody, when you tell somebody that, nobody believes you. They think you're crazy or something like that. And then she saw about the paranormal group. She called them immediately. She thought, well, maybe they can come help me. And she, of course, it turned out that hers was, you know, due to her phones having a high electromagnetic field causing her to hallucinate. But then not too long after that, there's something happens that you wonder if that was really it or not. Mrs. Gage, it's kind of a similar situation. Her husband just passed away, and he had installed a breaker box, and she thought he may be trying to communicate with her. And that's why, you know, she was having the paranormal issues that she was.
That's scary. That's actually scary. But, I wonder how much of this is really real, that people actually think that somebody that died is actually communicating with them, and they feel it's real, I guess, after going through this. So what is the difference between a paranormal investigation and ghost hunting? Because I did look up both of them before I wrote your book review. I did, because I wanted to understand. There's a difference between both of those, right?
There is. A paranormal investigation should follow the scientific method closely. You know, like we've been talking about, recording data, recording baselines.
Mm-hmm.
I think nature, ghost hunting is kind of what people do for fun. They'll go out to an alleged haunted location and set up their recorders and take pictures, but that's about it. So I guess you'd say ghost hunting is more or less for fun. Paranormal investigation is actually an attempt to do research on paranormal.
Yeah, but they don't exactly find anything. And do they actually believe that they're going to see a ghost? And what would they do if they actually did see one? I don't know.
Well, see, some people do, and they believe that so strongly that anything they see or experience is automatically a ghost. So that's why it's so important to go in with an open mind and go into it scientifically, because you can see whatever you want to see. But is it actually true what you're saying?
That's scary. So Jeff had these people in his group. Why didn't he investigate them to learn more about them before he did? He just accepted them because they had a reason to want to, you know, somebody's mother, somebody's grandmother, somebody's ex-wife, somebody's wife that died. How come he just allowed them to join the group and didn't investigate to see who they really were? Well, what they were really about.
I think a lot of that was he was using that first meeting as kind of a measuring stick to kind of size all of them up, and he he got a good feeling about him, but I think the other hand is he had been attempting to do paranormal investigation with these other groups that just weren't really going anywhere, and he was kind of in desperation mode. It's like, okay, I've got these people. Let's go with it. Let's get it done. I think it was more or less he was tired of spinning his wheels and ready to go somewhere, so he didn't do the background checks, if you will, that he should have done.
So how would he have done a background check? Did he have access to like, you know, FBI reports or anything like that? Or police reports? How would he know? Or you can just look them up online? But a lot of that stuff, I mean, I look up some that stuff too, and they ask you to pay for it. They tell it's a free lookup of a person or a free phone number, and then they ask you for $20 every month or whatever.
Yeah, the average Joe, that's the way you can do it. You can pay the fee and look at it. Maybe Jeff was too cheap to pay the fee too, but that's unless you're actually in law enforcement or know somebody in law enforcement, that's really the best way to do it. I mean, when I joined a paranormal group, I don't even think they did a background check. And the group I was in was a member of the Taps family. You know, the guys from Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
So they have stricter standards on the members. So, I would just say in Jeff's case, it was just a matter of him being desperate to get started and not wanting to wait and be bogged down with background checks, which is not entirely wise.
Yeah, how would that something like that backfire in his case or any case?
Well, as you'll see in the course of the book, there is a little bit of backfiring going on with that. I don't want to give away too much, though.
No, don't, no. But, yeah, they'll have to read that for themselves to learn more about each of these characters. And when they do, they better all read the book with the lights on, seriously. Very seriously. So each one joined for a reason, and yet at times each one seemed different. They didn't all seem to join together. How did this group get along? They didn't seem to get along that well. And were these investigations done the way you would do them?
More or less, with the equipment we had, that was kind of the way we would do them. And it was the same situation. You'd have, you know, you had a character in the book that didn't want to do baselines. He just wanted to get in there and start ghost hunting, basically. That's basically how we did it in every investigation. We'd go and do baselines, and so we would have a, basis for comparison whenever something went out of the whack that night, or you know, something happened that was out of the ordinary.
So when Debbie finally does talk to her granny again, does she give her any more information? Or does she calm down finally and, you know, tell her anything?
She doesn't. She kind of calms down to Debbie, but asks that she respects her wishes. But Debbie ultimately finds out from a police officer later in the book.
Well, before I forget, I don't want to forget, Monday I'm on the air at 1 o'clock with Alan Jacobson and Michael Embry and I hope a third person, and we're going to talk about our school safety plans, evacuation plans, and whether people think teachers should be armed and who should be there to protect students in a school. On the 15th, the author of Look for Her. On the 19th, Well-Timed Murder, Get Your Watches Set. On the 21st, New York Times author Mark Cameron, that writes for Tom Clancy, Power Empire. On the 26th, Charles Salzberg, Second Story Man. And on the 29th, I'm doing a very special show because my caregiver's guide should be coming out next week or the week after. We're going to talk about Alzheimer's, elder care abuse, and traumatic brain injury, and what it takes to be a caregiver for someone that has any one of these issues, and how you work to get rid of elder care abuse if someone in your family has it, where you should go, and the resources are there. on the 4th, a show that I asked to do with Minister Sam Oliver. We're going to talk about forgiveness, kindness, and understanding, and how we can teach children and people to get along better in this world. I think we need that. And on the 5th, straight from Scotland, Alex Gray, Silent Games. Oh, my God. I loved Inspector Lorimer. So, got more questions here. Why is the death theory defined in this novel considered by the group immoral and unethical in application? And why do they discount it?
Well, it's unethical because you actually have to monitor somebody at the time they die. And, I mean, how would you accomplish that going to, you know, a hospice or something like that? That's just unethical and, you know, bordering on immoral. So they don't renounce the theory, but they all kind of put it to the side because it's interesting food for thought. But when they realize the implications of what it means to test that theory, it's you know, more than anybody's willing to do or should do.
That's scary. There was an author, Kira Peacock, that was talking about that, not last year, the year before. I was hoping she would come back on. She was writing a book about what happens when somebody dies and has a heart attack and how you can bring them back. And I was hoping that when my sister died, they tried it, but it didn't work. I guess she had a brain injury too, so it didn't work to bring her heart back. They said if a person dies within 8 hours or something, you can actually bring them back. And I wonder how true that is at times also. So, a former colleague of Jeff proclaimed the demonologist believes a demon force is attached to the group. Is that true?
That's what he believed. That's kind of up to the interpretation of the reader once they, you know, get to the end of the book. The guy obviously believed that, or he wouldn't have taken the time to call Jeff and tell him that, but that's something I wanted to leave open to, you know, the reader to decide for themselves.
Well, I read this really fast, and it's scary. So what happens when she says to Jeff, I'm in the book, I'm looking at it right now, on page 262. I've been having bad nightmares, she says, pushing the comforter over the puddle in the carpet, and I'm getting help with them, but you can see they haven't found the cure. Do they ever find a cure for nightmares? And she thinks that Dr. Staples is the right one. But is he the right one?
Well, she ultimately comes to terms with what's causing the nightmares. And it quote-unquote cures her. But whether he's the right one or not, that's, you know, something to be left open in the book.
Well, Jeff decided to have an investigation, and everyone agreed to some and to meet at the old woman's home at 5 o'clock. And Mrs. Gage lived in a house. So what happened when they went there? I mean, this is spooky. And then Mrs. Schwender's, it was her phones, right, that were no good? So if disconnecting the phones was what was the solution, what does she do if she has to communicate? She can't?
No, that's something. Well, they told her to get a new phone, but like you said, that was one thing the investigating officer brought up. So, you know, so she couldn't make a phone call, and they were kind of like, "We didn't think of that." They were just so excited to find out her cause and to find the cure for her. They didn't consider the implications of, you know, her not being able to make a phone call for a while.
I wonder how people would feel about that. I don't know. So tell us, who is Dr. Mallett? And why did he come to deal with Debbie? Yeah.
He's just the doctor at the hospital that was treating her.
And did he know what was wrong with her? Would he ever be able to figure out what was wrong with her?
Well, her injuries. But he wasn't examining her psychologically. It was, you know, mainly the injuries she sustained in the book. So he was kind of the ER doctor on call, if you will, and she was brought in.
Yeah, well, they don't ask a lot of questions, I know. Trust me, I know that. So why did they have to guard her room?
Because the person that did her harm was still out on the loose.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the only one who had seen them.
So how does she wind up with Jeff? How do they wind up getting along at all? And is he going to continue to do this? Does he think this is a vocation that he can learn more, or is he going to give this up?
I think considering everything that happens in the book, he gives it up. Of course, you never know.
I know. Can I tell you? The ending is quite shocking, without telling anybody. How did you create the ending, and is there going to be a sequel, I hope?
The ending, to be honest with you, I can't give you an honest answer how I came up with it. It just, when I was in the process of writing, I was trying to figure out how I was going to wrap all this up, and it just kind of came to me. As far as a sequel, I actually have thought about it, but the question of where to go next is, you know, kind of the big sticking point. I have another trilogy that I wrote that's been out there for a little while, and I originally wrote it as one book, and I was like, okay, that's it, that's the story. Yeah, it's got a little bit of a cliff ending, but people can figure it out, and all I heard after that book came out was, you know, what happens next. So a single book turned into a trilogy in that case, so who knows, Death Theory may have a sequel one of these days.
Well, where would you, I didn't ask this question. I'm looking at the book. It's in front of me. I always keep the book in front of me. Where did this novel take place? Why the Ozark Mountains?
It's kind of an area I'm familiar with. Of course, I live in Arkansas, so Springfield and Branson's only a couple hours from me. Kind of like,
so that makes,
you know, Stephen,
go on.
Why does Stephen King write about Maine? Because he lives there. He's familiar with it.
That does make it easier. Is it better that when you know the setting and where a story takes place, you know, so that you can actually picture it in your mind, right? So when you create
yeah.
the scenes or the scenery, you can sort of say, you sort of like in your mind that's where it went. So at the end of the book, without giving the ending away, because I'm not giving anything away, I have to tell you that everywhere I go, whether it's the doctor's office, the dentist, the diner, my accountant right after this to do taxes, everybody's got their hands out for books, seriously. And I know that my accountant's going to want this one. And I'm going to bring it. Yeah, it's amazing. I can't go in the elevator without someone saying to me, okay, I have a pad and a pen. Could you tell me what you just read? Okay, so for those of you that want to know what to read, Death Theory is a great book, and St. Patrick's Day is coming up, and I think people, you know, leprechauns will come and get you if you don't buy a couple of copies. So you may as well do that right now before you, you know, don't have, you know, the four-leaf clover and good luck with a shamrock. That's my belief. Philip Margolin, Third Victim, is fantastic. It's not out yet, but you want to order a copy of Brian Friedman, Alter Ego, and that was so scary. Charles Salzberg, Second Story Man, and my author for next week, look for her. That's really scary. And one book that everybody seems to be writing on sexting and sex trafficking, Abuse of Discretion by Pamela Samuels Young. That's just some of what I went up to. And as everybody knows, I read 10 books at the same time. I do, seriously. It keeps my mind going, and it just keeps me going. So if Jeff could talk to everybody right now, what would he say about his experience?
He would probably say it in one sentence, there's a better way to find answers.
What would he do
and
differently
I think
next time? Go on.
I was just going to say, I'm thinking anybody who's read the book would know exactly what that means.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he would investigate the people a little bit better, too. What do you think?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of mistakes made in the book that I think he would have done differently, given a second chance.
Well, if there weren't mistakes and it was too perfect, then it wouldn't be real, right?
That's
I
true.
mean,
There's
if
a
the,
lot of people.
yeah, I mean, murder is such my it's my favorite thing to read. I'm reading a couple of memoirs too, and I'm reading a book now about the girl that the terrorist that tried to kill Alexander II. And I'm trying to read it. Can I say? I'm also reading In Defense of Israel by the former defense and foreign minister, Moshe Arens. And actually, they asked me if I wanted to interview him. And first I have to read the book. Then I'll decide. It should be interesting.
Sounds like an interesting book.
Yeah, it is. It's a memoir of his life from the beginning, when he became a Zionist, when he joined B'Tsar, and when he joined different organizations. And I'm taking my time reading it because I want to make sure that I get what he's trying to say. You usually get what everybody says, but I want to make sure that I get it. I saw him being interviewed on I-24 on BBC television, and he's a tough interview. And the interviewer, you know, asked him a lot of questions about Syria, Palestine, and the president and everything like that, but she didn't read the book. And I think in his own mind, he was like, she kept saying, oh, you know, the book is out, blah, 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 but I didn't read it. And it probably would have been better if she just said, could you tell us something about the book so people want to buy it? And I don't know. We'll see. So final question. Death affects everyone in diverse ways. Occasionally time heals the wounds, and sometimes it takes more. When it's a sudden death and you don't expect it, it's hard. But when it's somebody that's been sick, it's hard. Is it ever easier to deal with it? Because my mom I knew was going to go because she had Alzheimer's, but my sister had a massive heart attack and I had no idea. So sometimes it's different. So it changes the grieving in ways that you can't imagine. So how do you deal with that? And how would somebody in this particular area that wants to talk to the person and find out what happened, how would you deal with that?
Well, I think when somebody, you know, when you know that somebody's in bad health and they're going to die soon, you kind of, I mean, it's never an easy thing when a loved one passes away. But at least in that case, you have the opportunity to kind of spend some quality time with them, to kind of start the grieving process. And when it's sudden like that, I mean, it knocks the wind out of you. And I've gone through something similar in my life. It wasn't me directly, but somebody that I know real well. I know it's you know, in that case, it really takes a while to get over.
Yeah, it does. As a matter of fact, there were days like yesterday when it was snowing, and I looked up at the sky and go, Marsha, are you there? Can you stop the snow? As a matter of fact, my network on Blog Talk Radio was called MJ Network after my sister, because she's the reason why I'm doing this. She instigated me to review books and said, when I retired from teaching, either you're going to become a 500-pound elephant, which I'm not, or you're going to do something with your life. And she dared me to review a book. And boy, am I glad she did. And then she dared me to do radio. And I miss the fact that she used to go over the questions. Yeah, it was great. She was, I mean, this is probably, I don't get paid to do book reviews. I don't get paid to do the radio shows. I pay for this network. And then Cheryl says, I'm just giving the person the book and you're going to interview them. And I don't mind because Partners in Care is fantastic. Partners in Crime is great. They have been so amazing to me, and they did my blog tour, and they're the best. I'm surprised she's not listening. She must have an appointment, but I'm sure she'll listen later. So where can we learn more about you and your work, and what's next, and when am I getting it? You have to write a sequel. I mean, seriously, you have to write a sequel.
I'm definitely going to put that on my to-do list since you brought it up today. my website is johndmims.com. On Facebook, I'm under John D. Mims, author. Also, like I mentioned earlier, I have another trilogy of books out called the Tesla Gate Trilogy, which has to do with spirits, kind of a whole different way than death theory did. And I have a I'm editing, it's actually the first novel I wrote about 10 years ago.
Mm.
As you know, with anything, the more you do it, the more you practice it, the better you get with it.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote that first novel, it was a great story. I still love the story. But the writing was rather embarrassing, to say the least. So now that I've kind of honed my skills, if you will, I'm going back and editing that, and it should, I'm hoping it'll be out by the end of the year.
Well, that
sounds
exciting.
And it is called The Great Keep.
Oh, that sounds interesting. You know something, it's funny that you should say that, because I wrote a book in 2009 or 10 called Bertha Fights Back, and it's two stories of what I went through in junior high school. And the ending part of it, or the part of it that deals with gangs in school and what happens when there are fights and teachers stand around and do nothing, and what happens when the students have to take control. And it's based on real-life events growing up in the South Bronx. And I made it a little bit worse because I want people and teens to understand. And at the end, I created something that I created with my assistant principal, with my friend, a peer mediation program that, unfortunately, when the last principal came there, she did away with it, which was really bad because we never had fights. And no one got suspended. And everyone was able to work out their differences. And peer mediation did work for all the years that you know, she wasn't there. So that's Bertha Fights Back is going to be written back, and I think I'm going to call it Fighting Back, or maybe just The School. I haven't decided. So, yeah, you're right. You should rewrite something, and it does come out better. So I want to thank you so much for today. This is so interesting. And if you want to send me something else to read, feel free to send me. It might take a while to read it because I have a huge pile, but I'd be more than interested to read the trilogy, seriously.
Well, for everybody that, you know, prefers different formats, Death Theory is available in paperback, Kindle, and audiobook on Audible. So wide range of ways you can get it.
That is great. Well, thank you so much for today. Everybody, the sun is shining, and Fran is going to get back to her reading for a couple of minutes, and then I'm going to do my other errands. I want to thank you so much, and when the next book comes out, I hope I get it and do another interview. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you so much, John. This was fun. This is interesting. I learned a lot, let me tell you. And I think the next time I have a lucid dream, I'm going to try to remember it a little bit better. And I hope I never have to have a worry about having a nightmare. Thank you so much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you.